see, I hear God's children praying in jail. I hear God's children, you know they're suffering. I hear God's children praying in jail. Oh, Bratton, oh, Compass, oh, Bratton, open themselves.
Newsflash. Asthma is the number one reason why black and brown youth end up in the hospital across the country. And somewhere in New Orleans, a little child of African descent will be cleaning deadly black mold off her mother's, grandmother's, great-grandmother's, and great-great-grandmother's bedroom floor. And as toxic particles force her chest to tighten, she can hear the silenced echo of all her brothers and sisters across the country. But she stands tall. The memory of her ancestors singing Negro spirituals in the back-breaking cotton fields fortifies her posture. The beating of Yoruba rhythms in Congo Square pounds her chest open. The humming of freedom hymns in the street grounds her feet. And somewhere down the street, the sound of yellow tape being torn away from an uncontaminated housing project echoes throughout the Ninth Ward. The survivors of a second diaspora, twice removed from their land, are now reclaiming their home, shouting, "We shall not be moved." Eager to join the choir, she wakes unmoved, because even her breath has the right of return.
We shall not, we shall not be moved. We demand our land and sovereignty, our children's dreams will take root down in New
Flash. Garfield, walk out. Compton, walk out. Cleveland and Westchester, walk out. BRU, walk out. 70,000 students leave school desks empty, searching for the real lesson plan of the day. Lesson number one, you don't need a doctor's note to protest a sick system. Lesson number two, a truancy ticket is national oppression. And lesson number three, the history lesson of the day. Did you know the word nation is an acronym? It stands for, you never actually thought it was over now, did you? 15 million people take the streets before the bombs in Iraq even dropped. You never actually thought it was over now, did you? A million Latinos flood LA streets as part of a nationwide boycott. You never actually thought it was over now, did you? And a 10-year struggle turns a consent decree into a $2 billion check, and the BRU is screaming, ya basta. 1,000 less police, 1,000 more buses, louder than it ever has before. You never actually thought it was over now, did you? We are voices from a front line that has no end, no limits, and no borders. And somewhere in Louisiana, somewhere on the corner of Wilshire, will stand the little girl, the memory of her people, flooding the streets from horizon to horizon, endless, will leave her breathless. But when her breath returns, she'll whisper, we are on our way.
I'm on my way. I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way to freedom land. I'm on my way, oh Lord, to freedom land. If you don't go, don't you hinder me. If you don't go, it's an uphill journey, but I'm on my way. It's an uphill journey, but I'm on my way. It's an uphill journey, but I'm on my way. I'm on my way. Oh Lord, the freedom land. There's nothing you can do to turn me around. There's nothing you can do to turn me around. There's nothing you can do to turn me around. I'm on my way, oh Lord, to freedom land. I'm on my way, oh Lord, to freedom land. I'm on my way, oh Lord, to freedom land.
Was that not deep? Was that not deep? I still tremble when I hear it, and this is not the first time. My name is Barbara Lott Holland. I am co-chair of the Bus Riders Union. I also chair the weekly meeting of the Planning Committee. I am also a member of the community rights groups. I'm also a member of the Theatro. And these are all projects of the Labor Community Strategy Center. You know, when I was young and growing up in Houston, Texas, my parents, well, and all the grown-ups, as a matter of fact, my whole neighborhood, voted Democratic. And so I grew up voting Democratic, and I, like them, believed in the Democratic Party. I believed that it was the party of the poor, the party of the oppressed, and especially the party of black people. And the white Democrats were decent, not necessarily our friends, but they were decent. And so we supported this party. And with this, we were happy, elated, to see black people become a part of this party. And we became color struck due to this. Out of maybe we couldn't or we wouldn't, but we turned a blind eye to the compromises that they made to the black struggle. We could not see that they had exchanged that struggle for the gilded cage. Well, since that time, my reality has changed. And it was really pointed out to me when I was at the Congressional Black Caucus, and I saw them ineffectively fight for a very good motion that they had put before Congress on the right of return of the black nation to New Orleans. Very painful indeed. And so when I read this passage in Eric's book, it really hit home for me. And here's the book, but you know, I'm old, so I had to write it real big. But it is on page 184. It is "The Movement Begins with What We Have." Very important, with what we have. And it reads, "The white liberals have abandoned any commitment to our concerns about the inner city and are obsessed with saving the sinking ship of the Democratic Party. They represent no independent base, no social movement to compare with the vitality of the right. And unlike the right, who keep pushing the Republicans' gun control, gay marriages, escalation of hostility to immigrants, The liberals make no demands on the Democrats except, here's my money, please try to defeat Bush. For them, campaign finance reforms or electing a new congressman from Ohio is more compelling than addressing the system's racism that perpetrates the crisis of New Orleans. So that's the dilemma. Is there no hope? Of course there is. And a good remedy to that is found on page 54. The chapter is titled, Fighting Katrina Fatigue, Supporting the Black Leadership in the Grassroots. And it reads, given the capitulation of the Democrats and the crisis of the congressional black leadership, the simple but profound realization is that grassroots, black-led, working-class-based labor community groups must lead the resistance.
Hello, everybody. My name is Francisca Porchas, and I am a lead organizer of the Strategy Center's Clean Air, Clean Lungs, Clean Buses campaign. I am a Mexicana immigrant. I am a Latinoamericana, and I am also a Chicana. And I was first drawn to the Labor Community Strategy Center, searching for a place to do on-the-ground organizing with an anti-racist analysis, and I found it. And this book carries in every page the validation of black people and their right to return, and validation of national oppression. Having organized in the streets of Los Angeles, having traveled to New Orleans 3 weeks after the storm, and preparing myself to go back to New Orleans in the next couple of weeks, I will carry with me the profound understanding of the following stated in the book, Katrina's Legacy. And it goes a little something like this. The suppression of an anti-racist analysis is part of an ideological offensive against the black reconstruction or any form of a black political accession and fight back. Any white organizers who have been given the gift of being part of a second reconstruction, the civil rights and black liberation movement, north or south, can attest to the generosity and courage of the black masses and their unquestioned ability to distinguish between white friend and foe. But rarely is such generosity reciprocated by white liberals, white labor, or even some in the multiracial left, who believe that class unity is best served by posing colorblind, metaphysically unified working class or movement, in which, according to this view, too much talk about race, especially the oppressed black race, is harmful to the greater, if never clearly defined, broader goal. As such, perhaps the greatest blow to the movement is put forth by those who try to deny the obvious, that Hurricane Katrina has been one of the great blows to the black community in the 21st century. The New Orleans was a majority black city and a hub of black, southern, and national culture. And that the right to return means the right of the black New Orleans diaspora to return to their own black city. Those simple and undeniable thoughts are now being whited out by a hostile white majority in the country, an ascendant white majority with the hopes of becoming the new majority in New Orleans, and perhaps most disturbingly, by some in the labor movement and the left. Ironically, throughout U.S. history, we have seen that during black-led progressive periods, many white workers have been won over to a broader left program based on a profound understanding of black liberation and white supremacy. And they fought for black demands as part of an overall revolutionary and, at times, socialist strategy. Thank you.
Good evening. My name is Leanne Hurstman. I work with the National School for Strategic Organizing, and I'm the editor of Our Now, the bilingual political journal that we put out at the Strategy Center. I spent my childhood in the South during the end of the apartheid years, the period that Eric refers to as the first counter-revolution. I was lucky enough to witness the second Reconstruction coming into being. As a child, all I really understood was that my parents were part of a fight for civil rights. I had no idea that this battle had already been fought and won during the Civil War, that there was, in fact, the victory of the first black Reconstruction. In getting to know Eric over the last 32 years, I've come to understand that black liberation movement more deeply and its relationship to the struggle for civil rights. I always tell people that when we met, we merged our politics. I was a socialist feminist who grew up in the civil rights movement. He had just come out of prison and was submerged in revolutionary black nationalism. Over all these years, our greatest political unity has been our common commitment to black liberation. In this book, Eric takes us all back to the first Reconstruction, the one no one in this room experienced. I'd like to share with you one of my favorite passages from that section, the first Reconstruction, which starts on page 24. In 1865, less than 150 years before black people in the South won legal freedom from slavery, millions of black women and men were thrust onto the historical stage. Launching the first Reconstruction period after the Civil War, a black political class emerged. They were able to create an alliance of black freed men and women, some Southern poor whites and workers, Northern abolitionists, and the radical Republicans. This United Front coalition drafted a program to consolidate the victory over the rebellious and racist Southern Confederacy. And they passed some of the most progressive legislation and social policies in U.S. history. This plan was based on the material power of more than 150,000 armed blacks who had rebelled against slavery and fought with the North in the Civil War, backed by 4 million more who were potentially armed. Imagine a period in which more than 4 million black women and men, after 3 centuries of slavery, are instantly freed. They enter the post-Civil War world with little history of training in politics, no history of even the relative freedom within oppression of the colonized people in Africa, no permitted relationships with whites, except an always terrorized set of adaptations and charades as tactics of self-defense. Imagine what a revolution it was to have former slaves, women and men, leading a political movement out after centuries of being denied their families, their right to read and speak their mind, the right to travel outside of the plantation. This limited history of common activity was restricted by the yoke of bondage to field slave slowdowns and sabotage. The miracle of the Underground Railroad and the galvanizing, brave, brief slave rebellions that were passed on as folklore by word of mouth as the ultimate model of hope. This consciousness, leadership, and organization was geometrically expanded in the period of the few short years between 1860 and 1865, in which black slaves rose up against their overextended masters, fled the plantations, enlisted in the Union Army, and were given freedom, training, and most importantly, guns. Let us imagine, as this book helps us do, what our third Reconstruction might be. Thank you.
Hello, everybody. My name is Patrice Cullors. I'm a member of the Labor Community Strategy Center, and I sit on the Community Rights Campaign, and I help run the Drum and Chant Crew. Black women, a force to be reckoned with. Although our lives were very much devastated by the police, welfare, and drugs, the black women in my life held the family together many times with just sheer hope. Hope that the police wouldn't arrest one other of our peoples. Hope that the bus would come on time and we wouldn't end up late to our doctor's appointment. Hope that we could make rent. I watched the black women in my family hold down three jobs and raise four children. Too often, the system was too big and too horrible to combat, and we were left with the reality that this white supremacist system was and is our worst enemy. The majority of our partners, brothers, fathers, and sons are locked up in prison. And we, black women, are left with the responsibility that a lot of the times feels like a burden on raising the next generation of black youngsters. That of the survivors of Katrina, 75 to 80% of them were women. In New Orleans, 56% of the households are led by women, compared to 25% for the nation as a whole. The demands for black women are critical building blocks towards the third Reconstruction. Women hold up half of the sky, and without the black women throughout the first and second and now third black Reconstruction, there would be no Reconstruction. So I want to read a couple things from this amazing book, and this is in the part around black women and the eye of the storm. The first paragraph. The focus on the black community in New Orleans also requires a focus on the specific oppression and strategic role that women play in the post-Katrina battle for Reconstruction. It also requires analysis and specific programmatic demands to address the needs of low-income, working-class black women as a critical force within the entire multiracial women's movement, the entire black movement, and the worldwide united front against racism and imperialism. While the factors and the cycle of poverty are complex and cumulative, the right of low-income women who are overwhelmingly black to defend the integrity of our own bodies, reflected in access to birth control, protection against forced sterilization, and the right to government-funded safe abortions is a critical component of the solution. the demands of low-income black women and the Gulf Coast for social welfare programs and an end to government-encouraged prostitution and full reproductive rights aggressively defended by men and a revitalized black community and progressive movement are critical building blocks of a third reconstruction. Thank you so much, sisters and brothers, for engaging in this entire first section. Let's welcome author of Comrade George and now Katrina's legacy, Eric Mann.
Katrina's legacy, white racism and black reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. It's that contradiction between white racism and black reconstruction that still offers the greatest hope for Latinos, for Asian Pacific Islanders, for anti-racist whites, for people in the third world looking for some hope in the United States, from the people of Palestine to the people of Lebanon to the people of Venezuela who urgently need our help. When Katrina happened and we saw the black bodies beginning to float down the river, sometimes what's kind of scary is how quickly you can understand something. When September 11th happened, my first reaction, very frankly, was we are in trouble. Not the United States is in trouble, but we on the left are in grave trouble because this is a country, the United States, that always thinks it's being attacked as it is the attacker. The United States thinks that Fidel Castro attacked them for simply taking back the land that was Cuba's to have. The United States thought the Vietnamese attacked them for asking for control of their own country after the French were driven out by the Vietnamese. And the United States chose to kill 3 million people with cluster bombs, napalm, on the grounds that the communists had to be stopped in Vietnam or else they would be where? In Los Angeles? I only wish. The United States is always the aggressor and claims it's always being attacked. Note Israel's new way of playing the game. Whatever happens to Israel, it has been attacked, and therefore it must inflict the most odious damage on civilian populations. It must carry out war crimes. In the name of what? In the name of a Holocaust? No, because the Holocaust, which my family went through, was inflicted on us as Jews by the Germans. Why didn't Israel ask for part of Germany? Why didn't the Jews ask for part of Germany? Why did they take what was not theirs? Because the history of European Western Christian capitalist imperialism is based on first taking what is not yours, and then secondly, demonizing those from whom you took it, and third, using concepts of white supremacy to degrade the culture, the intellect, the humanity of the very people from whom you stole it in a classic Freudian form of projection, in which it's the white oppressor who should look in the mirror. It's the white oppressor who should be worried about who she or he is, but instead it's the white oppressor that has opinions about everything from the racial configuration to the mental intelligence to the culture, to the morals of the very people that are living in advanced civilizations. That is to say, it's the United States that goes into an advanced African civilization, an advanced indigenous civilization, destroys that civilization, and then comes out somehow in the alchemy of white supremacy that those of us who are white and Christian who killed the others are somehow God's chosen people. So we have our work cut out for us. And just as shortly after September 11th, I understood that we were in trouble and that this was going to be used for every right-wing invasion throughout the world, within a day or two of Katrina, every black person understood what was happening. Jesse Jackson, who has his moments, unfortunately very few, said, in looking at the Superdome, I saw the hold of a slave ship. Kanye West, who had his moment, said, George Bush doesn't care about black people. But the next day, he did not continue to say that. Bob Bullard of Clark Atlanta University said, if New Orleans is 70% black and 30% white, then how come everybody in the Superdome was black? Where were the white folks? What that shows is that race trumps class inside the United States. This is not about... Because there were poor white folks in New Orleans, but they were not trapped in the Superdome. Now, many of you came here through an excellent event that we had, and we turned out within 30 days of Katrina. I had written, sort of by staying up all day and all night for 30 days, a letter to the movement in support of the forces in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast. I could have just let it there, I just could have let it go, but I had a certain obsession about the situation in New Orleans, which is I felt like I was watching a war crime happen in front of me. I would stop writing if it stopped. I would stop writing if the white racism stopped. I would stop writing if the black people came back and exercised their right of return. I could move on to my next book. But the problem was that there was a movement developing in the country. It was unfortunately not primarily a movement for the right of return. It was primarily a movement to deny the right of return to black people who had been dispersed from New Orleans. I started doing the math. At first, I couldn't believe the math. New Orleans is a city, was a city, pre-Katrina, of 500,000 people. It was 67% black. The way I do my math is I round off, so I get to 70%. 70% of 500,000 people is 350,000 black people. New Orleans is now no more than 200,000 people. There's some people that think it's only 150,000 people. Of that, it is no more than 50% black, and that may be a very generous number. You take 50% of 200,000, you get 100,000. You subtract it from 350,000, you get 250,000 black people who have been driven out of the most Afrocentric, black-centered, black-majority city in the United States in 1 year, and no one is fighting to bring them back except themselves. But worse than that, the New Orleans Police Department, the National Guard, the U.S. Army, FEMA, Office of Homeland Security, are working to physically prevent them from even going back on their own to retake that city. We are getting reports that housing projects that always had mold, that always were decrepit and dilapidated, that the people are coming back from Houston, black people, coming back from Atlanta, breaking in to the contaminated housing projects to just with their own bare hands trying to clean up what was once theirs, only to be arrested for trespass. Not to have the U.S. government arrested for a year later not fixing up the public housing, but almost to physically prevent black people from returning. Can I get a bottle of water? Is that good? Thanks, Carol. So you have to pick your fights, and for a lot of reasons, not just myself, but a lot of the people at the Strategy Center have said, we want to pick the fight with the MTA, we want to pick a fight with the LAPD, we want to pick a lot of fights, but we want to pick a fight to be one of the strongest movements in the country in support of the people of New Orleans. We want to make this a long-term campaign because the right of return exists as long as black people are willing to fight to exercise it. And we are not a group that gives up on things. We've spent 12 years fighting the MTA. We're willing to fight the city of New Orleans, the Democratic Party in New Orleans and Louisiana, the Bush administration, the Kerry administration, the Clinton administration, part two, we hope not, the McCain administration. Tonight in Los Angeles, we're going to talk about what we can really do to help New Orleans. But the first thing I want to do is talk to you about a little history. Because one of the very sad things about young black people today in particular is that they have such a proud and rich history that has been stolen from them. And by not knowing their own history, and by all of us not knowing black history, which is a gift to all of us, it is one of the greatest thefts, as one of the greatest thefts of black land. So the first thing I urge you to do is when you hear a book called Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction in New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, you should know that this book is based on the teachings of W.E.B. Du Bois and his formative book, Black Reconstruction in America. In that, he covers about a 20-year period from the original war in Kansas, whether it was going to be a slave or a so-called free state, to the end of the Civil War, to 1877. And during that period, as Leanne read a section, there was a moment when, imagine, 4 million black slaves who had been denied the right to read, denied the right of self-defense, denied the right to have a family, were thrust on the historical stage and commended themselves incredibly. They fought for the right to vote. They fought for better land. You know, you've heard about like 40 acres and a mule, but when we went back and studied the history, unfortunately it says no more than 40 acres and a mule. So even that was a myth. We went back and studied the 13th, 14th, and 15th Amendment. 13th Amendment, when I was in high school, you know, you learn these little mnemonics. Free citizens vote. So the 13th Amendment freed the slaves, 14th Amendment made them citizens, and the 15th Amendment gave black men the right to vote. But in my book, when you actually see the section on the 13th Amendment, it said, Congress shall eliminate slavery, and then there's a dash. And it says, unless people are convicted for crimes. And then it says, in these United States. So right away, they were trying to say that there is going to eliminate slavery, except. And the except is if we can re-enslave you through the criminal justice system. Today, in the United States, there are 2.2 people in prison, 2.2 million, of whom 1 million are prisoners. But if you talk to friends like Patrice Cullors, and you ask her how many members are in her family, the number of people influenced by a young man or woman in prison is the whole family. So often, it may be 5 million people who are really in prison trying to visit their children, which means that there are 5 million slaves today in the United States who are involuntarily enslaved by the United States government. And we have to build a movement, and that's why in my book, Katrina's Legacy, I disagree with the concept of the prison industrial complex and call it the racist re-enslavement complex. Because the prison industrial complex, while helpful, is a fundamentally economic analysis. It indicates that maybe all these folks are in prison because the system is looking for cheap labor, because the system wants to build prisons. I'm afraid if that was only the problem, if it was just economic, we could solve that problem. But if it is rooted in in the hatred, the punitiveness of white Christian capitalism towards black people in particular, who want to continue to punish them for their right to be free, then it is not a rational economic motivation, but it's a psychiatric problem rooted in the society as a whole of white settler state capitalism. And that's why and if you don't believe me, in our community rights group, we've been studying, thanks to Meg Young and others, the truancy program in LAPD. I'm sorry, in LAUSD. that was a Marxian slip. When I was a kid, when I was a nice little white kid in Long Island, you know, in the middle class white school, truancy was like, bad boy, you were late for school. Oh, no, no, go sit in the corner. It was no big thing. You were late. I used to cut class. I found I had a study hall that I figured out how to get out of. I got out of it for my whole senior year. I went to the park. One day I got caught. When I got caught, the principal said to me, Eric, this is no way for somebody on his way to Cornell to act. That was the level of oppression that I felt. Now I realize I have some advice for black folk. Because there really is a way to get away from the criminal industrial complex, the racist re-enslavement complex. I want you to go and get a really nice car, okay? I want you to get drunk. I want you to go tear-assing down the highway at 80 miles an hour. When you get arrested, I want you to make sexist slurs on the officer who arrests you and then say those Jews are responsible for all the problems and you damn well not arrest me because I gave $10,000 to Lee Baca and you will get an Academy Award because your name will be Mel White Boy Gibson. So, and then you can say how sorry you are, how penitent you are for the anti-Semitic tirade. So we still live at a time where the cruelty towards black people, the terror that black people feel driving late at night when they didn't do anything, is so different from the sense of privilege of a drunk Hollywood anti-Semite who doesn't even realize that of all the things to not do in Hollywood in the movie industry is be an anti-Semite. You know, you can do it anywhere else, but don't do it in Hollywood. So we're trying to build a movement. We're trying to build a movement in LA. We're trying to build a movement in New Orleans. And we're trying to build a movement around a book. Here's the short story. Black people in slavery, as Randall Robinson points out, for 246 years. They were freed in 1865. Do you know what year the Ku Klux Klan was formed? 1865. Do you know what Angola plantation was in 1865? You know what it became in 1866? Angola prison. By 1877, black people had all the land that they were given stolen from them, given back to white Southern troops, whose kids today wear Confederate flags on their trucks and dream of, I wish I was in Dixie. In Dixieland, I'll take my stand to live and die in Dixie. I believe in the First Amendment, except for that song. You know, that song should be banned as racist speech. From 1877 to 1953 was a period of tremendous terror in this land. It was called the first counter-revolution against the first Reconstruction. in 1954, and if you know about history and we had more time, history is not static. There was resistance throughout. There was the Underground Railroad. There was resistance to Jim Crow. There were armed black people against Jim Crow. But in history, sometimes you make these broad categories. So in 1954 starts what we call the Second Reconstruction. 1954, Brown versus Board of Education. 1955, the Montgomery bus boycott. 1955, the Mandung Conference of Non-Aligned Nations in Indonesia, where the countries of the Third World began to talk about independence from the Soviet Union and the United States, which was really code for independence from the United States. Because, in fact, Zhou Enlai showed up from Communist China and got a standing ovation from all the Third World people who were not neutral about communism. And Nehru from India was not neutral about socialism and independence from the United States. So those were very exciting times. And from 1955 to the defeat of the United States in Vietnam in 1975 is what I call the two decades of the 60s and the Second Reconstruction. But the terms, and you read this in the chapter called History Can Guide Us, by 1968, the white backlash had begun. By 1968, Richard Nixon had been elected president. But it took till 1980, when Ronald Reagan was president, that the full second counter-revolution began. And in my book, I'll take you through Ronald Reagan and one of the most serious counter-revolutionaries, Bill Clinton, who passed the effective, seriously, Bill Clinton passed the Effective Death Penalty and Counter-Terrorism Act. And you look at that act that he did, and Bill Clinton began the discussion of the military state against terrorism and kicked black women and other women off welfare. I'm hearing more and more things about the reactionary breakthroughs during the Clinton administration. And then we had, of course, 2 terms now of George W. Bush. We're in a lot of trouble. We're in a lot of trouble to try to build the Third Reconstruction, because the Third Reconstruction will exist against the Second Counter-Revolution. So why do I believe there is hope for a Third Reconstruction? And why is this book, in its most fundamental aspect, asking you to learn the history of the First Reconstruction and the Second Reconstruction, because we need desperately a Third Reconstruction? Now, the Third Reconstruction is not fundamentally socialist, although it can be socialist influenced, and needs to be, in fact, socialist influenced. But the Third Reconstruction is essentially what we call an anti-racist, anti-imperialist united front, which is really what the First and Second Reconstructions were as well. It's a broad united front in which our goal begins with something I want to talk about, which is black liberation and the concept of a black nation. At the heart of it is a strategic alliance of the oppressed nationality peoples, black, Latino Mexicano, Asian Pacific Islander, indigenous, led by the working classes of those oppressed people. It's also based on an alliance of all the working class people in this country, including the white workers, in alliance with the nations of the Third World against the common enemy, U.S. imperialism, and both parties that represent it. That's what's called a strategy. That means that for the rest of your life, until we overthrow imperialism, that is your strategy. My book is a tactic to advance that strategy. But tonight I want to talk to you about one big piece of that strategy, which is the Black United Front and the concept of a black nation. How can there be a black nation inside the United States? How can there be a separate nation? How could it be true that in some people's opinion, in some people's assessment, black people in the United States are both part of the United States, but an oppressed people in the United States with special rights? Special rights based on a special oppression. Those rights include the right to reparations, the right to be paid back for centuries of slavery in the transatlantic slave trade and the violation of people's human rights. Those rights include the right to be freed from prison en masse, based on a constitutional concept that if a group of people are subjected to the violation of their civil rights in a way that's systematically racist, they have the right to be free, just like one person, just like those who were convicted in the Ramparts scandal. In fact, if you looked at the individual cases of black people in prison, you would see that as a group, if you figured out inadequate counsel, lying police, planted evidence, if the glove does not fit, you must acquit, was not just for OJ, but for many, many of the black people in prison, we would have the grounds to free the U.S. 2 million. And as I've said before, if you ask an angry white person today who just lost his pension and was thrown out, what would you rather have, your pension or OJ in the electric chair? 90% would say, get OJ. It's the kind of, again, psychopathology of white racism, that the white worker, even when he loses his pension, has more anger towards black people, real and imagined, than towards the capitalist who just kicked him out. We're not writing off those white workers, but we are realizing that if we don't address them in a fundamentally anti-racist frame, we have no chance to ever reach them, because that's what's going on in their mind, is a racist frame. So we have to break that frame down in order to even reach and see if there's a heart and soul inside that body. So back to the concept of a black nation. I want to talk to you about the concept of black land in the United States. My proposal is to get rid of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Idaho, but I got some more. I'm better with my mouth than manipulating paper. Hold on though, bear with me here. So we're going to get rid of Maine, Vermont, New Hampshire, Idaho, Iowa, and Montana. We're going to kick them out and give them those centers. I want to explain. This is how racism works in the United States. Maine, 1 million people. White, 97%. They get two senators. Vermont, you know how many people live in Vermont? 602,000, less than South LA. They get two senators. New Hampshire, 1 million people. White, 96%. Iowa, 2.9 million people. White, 94%. Montana, 902,000 people. White, 90.1%. You put all those people together, they only got 7 million white folks, but they got 6 states and 12 U.S. senators. 12. Now, 7 million people altogether. They got 2 senators, 2 U.S. senators per state. They have 12 votes in the United States Senate, those 6 states. Now we're going to go to Alabama. Total population, 4.4 million. Black population, 1.2 million. Total population of black people, 26%. Total number of senators in Alabama, none. Georgia, 8 million people. Black people in Georgia, 2.4 million. Percentage, 28%. Number of senators that they get, none. Number of electoral votes they get when the state votes? None, because the state votes all Republican, all white, all the time. Louisiana, 4.4 million people, white, 63%. Black, 1.5 million people, 32% of the population. Number of votes they got? None. Number of electoral votes? None. Number of black senators? None. South Carolina, 4 million people, of whom 1.2 million are black, 29-30%. Number of senators, none. Number of electoral votes, none. It all goes Republican. And finally, North Carolina, white, 5 million, black, almost 2 million. You get it. Check this out now. Number of black people in all the six states, 9 million people in the six states that I read. 9 million black people. They got no senators. Number of white people in the six states I read, 7 million. They got 12 senators. Now, what if black people broke out of those states? What if they said, we don't want to be in Alabama? We don't want to be in Mississippi. We don't want to be in Louisiana. We call for separate black states based on population, and we want to form a black belt of people with a vote in which each of us gets two senators. We want it based on one person, one vote, which is what the Constitution is supposed to say. And we damn well are not going to have 1.5 million people in Georgia have no senators and 600,000 people in Vermont have two. The point I'm raising is rather than thinking that the concept of a black nation is something so far away that you can't imagine it, part of organizing is getting you to imagine it. That's what Malcolm X was there for. Malcolm X was getting there to get you to imagine. Martin Luther King was there to get you to imagine. Amiri Baraka was there to get you to imagine. The Communist Party was there to get you to imagine. Not just to get a little bit more than what you got, but to raise your hope to a different kind of world. And the Strategy Center and our community rights campaign and Katrina's legacy is here to get a new generation of young black people to imagine a future to which they are entitled, a future that they deserve, a future that's been denied to them, denied generation after generation. Reparations is something that you deserve. States in the South is something you deserve. Black congressional district is something you deserve. Getting 1 million black people out of prison is something you deserve. But you got to imagine the possibility of asking for it before you can even imagine the possibility of getting it. Now, I want to talk about the third Reconstruction in Los Angeles. There are two parts of the third Reconstruction in New Orleans, and Los Angeles we need your help on. The Strategy Center and the Bus Riders Union has a new campaign called 1,000 More Buses, 1,000 Less Police. 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 All right. Mayor Villaraigosa, do you hear us? Let's start with 1,000 more buses. Everybody says they're for 1,000 more buses. That's the easy one. But we can't get 1,000 more buses because Mayor Villaraigosa and Governor Schwarzenegger want to dig a hole from Western Avenue to Fairfax on Wilshire that will cost about $2 billion to build. And at the end, you'll have a subway that'll cost you $4 or $5 billion from Western and Wilshire to Fairfax and Wilshire. Now, for those of you in good shape, you can walk from Weston to Fairfax. For those of you who would like public transportation, if you gave the Bus Riders Union that $5 billion, $5 billion, we could be running 24/7 bus service throughout Los Angeles. We could have a bus out here right now. We could have a rapid bus at midnight taking you wherever you want to go. We could have a shuttle from the bus to your home if you're disabled, if you're too old, or you just don't like the dark, like me. So imagine a 24/7 bus system. Imagine where you buy a pass for $20, right? 50 cent fare and $20 passes, because mass transportation belongs to the masses with a VRU, and this is our fight. Mass transportation is a human right. We want a 50 cent fare and $20 passes, because mass transportation belongs to the masses. You gotta imagine it before you can get it. Yeah. We've imagined it and we're starting to get it. So we could get a 24/7 bus service running with a 50 cent fare and a $20 pass. You could afford it if you don't build this crazy subway. But every bourgeois force in Los Angeles wants the subway. Every minority architect wants the subway. Every minority designer wants the subway. Every woman designer wants the subway. Because we don't need you to design the damn bus. We just need the bus, and we need a driver. And we know how to design it, because we have a 5-year plan in which we design all these routes. And as one time when Leanne and I were talking to a group of progressive architects who were trying to make the case for rail, finally a woman architect stood up and said, "Can we be honest here? We're just all at the trough. We want these contracts. We want a contract so a rail car could be called the Rosa Parks car. They'll even make it the Fidel Castro car. But we don't want you to name the car. We want the Fidel Castro bus and the Rosa Parks bus. So we want 1,000 more buses. But secondly, we really want 1,000 less police." The first thing, here's how I can save you already the 1,000 less police. All the police that beat up either us or their wives, I'm not kidding, should be laid off. When Leanne and I were in a Lamaze class having our first child, we were very friendly with this couple. And then the woman said to me one day, "Well," I said, "where's your husband?" "He's a policeman." She said, "He didn't come. He tends to get real upset when he comes home at work and shoots his gun into the ceiling." Now, we have to understand the level of mental instability that a lot of the police are faced with, partly because it's a rough job, and partly because who they recruit, and partly because of how they train them. They train them to go into war against us. Have you ever tried to just talk to a policeman? Just talk. "Excuse me, officer, I'm jogging at LA High." He just has that kind of face, you know, like, "Sir, did you hear what I said? You have to leave." "No, let me explain. See, I grew up here." "Sir, are you threatening me?" "No, officer. I said I was just, you know, jogging at LA High." "Do you know what time it is, sir? Do you realize this is disrespect to an officer? Do you want me to take my gun?" "No, officer, I'm getting out of LA High, because you are psychiatrically unstable, you know?" Have you ever been in a demonstration like No Seat, No Fare? Remember, Cynthia, when we were there? And the cops were trying to negotiate with them around that. And we're just, all we're doing is tagging buses with tape. And when they came up, they arrested us. And they arrested us with a lot of vigor. Not with hesitancy, "You're doing the right thing, I hate to do this, I feel bad about it." They did it with such enthusiasm. They took several of us, they took Alice Caputo Pearl and a couple of other people, brought him in to the prison and started doing head games. "Mr. Pearl, you're a teacher. Who's your principal? Do you have any disciplinary problems? Are you on probation?" Playing head games. If you've ever been behind bars, these cops are not good people. They don't act right. And I came up with the slogan then. 1,000 more buses, 1,000 less police. That's where I got it from, was to give it to the police a little bit. But it's very, very serious. It's serious for Devin Brown. It's serious, you know. I was going to take a picture, you know, Manuel Criollo, Damon, Francisca Porchas, a lot of us are working on this campaign. I was going to take a picture of all the cops hitting Rodney King and saying, exactly how many of them did you need, sir? I could get rid of 35 police just in that picture. How many police does it take to hit a black man? Wouldn't one be enough and we could arrest him, but you need 25 or 30? How many police does it take to kiss the ass of Hollywood and protect them every time they're having a shoot in our neighborhood? Get those folks. So how are they getting paid? Why are they protecting something like a script? Now, they say to us, but the community wants safety. First of all, we agree the community wants safety. We agree this problems of gangs is very serious. And we're not here tonight to give you the whole analysis, which we will some other night. But I'll tell you one thing. Do you know the most successful anti-gang program in the history of the United States? You know what it was? The Black Panther Party. I mean that. Ask Anthony Thigpen about this. Go back and get an old newsreel film about Fred Hampton, beautiful Fred Hampton, and watch him in Chicago at maybe 18 years old, having, I swear, 500 black youth in freezing Chicago at 6 in the morning, doing jumping jacks and wearing their berets and saying serve the people and saying breakfast for children. And those young kids were being interdicted away from gangs into a revolutionary movement that was armed, a revolutionary movement that gave people a sense of hope, a revolutionary movement that allowed them to imagine a future besides being stuck in the ghetto as a semi-slave. And what happened to Fred Hampton? Murdered in his bed by a police informer. How many more police do we need to shoot us in our beds when we are creating nonviolent or self-defense work in the community? So let's realize that the community's perceived need for police is a product of the 11 o'clock news. It's a product of the fact that there is not a left in the community challenging people. Do we need 2,000 police? Maybe. Do we need 1,000? We already got 8,700 police. And I'll tell you, there's too many of them for me. I don't know about you. But 1,000 less would just scratch the surface. Now, the mayor of Los Angeles, the progressive mayor of Los Angeles, is arguing for 1,000 more police and a subway in a way to destroy the social safety net. He is trying to take over the public schools in a way that's not about what's best for our kids, but is another power takeover. You know that terrible Schwarzenegger, downward Schwarzenegger, who we all hated? Well, now he apparently is a good friend of the mayor's, and he has supported the mayor's effort to take over the school. So while the mayor is not reaching out to the bus riders union or the strategy center, he's reaching out to Arnold Schwarzenegger for photo ops. The mayor is more progressive than some other mayors we could have had, but it's time to understand that 1,000 more buses and 1,000 less police is the kind of challenge for what the third reconstruction looks like in Los Angeles, because it is revolutionary. It's a revolution against the rail contractors. It's a revolution against the growing police state, because the police are tied to ICE, which is the Immigration Department. ICE is tied to the Office of Homeland Security. FEMA is tied to the Office of Homeland Security. Everything is tied to the Office of Homeland Security. And Chief Bratton is saying that he wants the LAPD to have a stronger relationship to the Office of Homeland Security. So if you're not scared, I worry about you. And we got to take it on, and that's what revolution looks like in the real world today. It's not some hypothetical thing. So finally, what does revolution look like in the South? It may not be a black nation today. It may not yet be the 20 million people in the South locked in to a series of states that they control with the right to determine their relationship to the United States up to including the right of secession. It may not look like that, but it must look like the right of return now. It must look like 250,000 black people must return today, and that is a revolutionary demand, and that is part of the third Reconstruction today. So I end with the book as a tactic. We had the honor of having 25 members of the Strategy Center who had all read the book, Katrina's Legacy, White Racism and Black Reconstruction, New Orleans and the Gulf Coast, come in and have an evening where people talked about what did the book mean to them. And the only prerequisites is you had to have read the book and you had to come in with some passages. And the passages that people came in with were so beautiful that sometimes I was shocked that I wrote them. And I got a beautiful, beautiful note from my friend Kamosi Woodard, who is quoted on this cover of the book. He's a professor of Afro-American studies at Sarah Lawrence and the New School in New York. And I organized him. In 1968, went door to door, some encouragement for some of our young organizers, found him in Weequahic High School, a young black man who wanted to join the revolution. I turned him over to my friend Phil Hutchings, who was part of the Brewer Community Union, and who later on became one of the chairmen of SNCC, and is going to be introducing me in the book in the Bay Area next week on our August 10th. So there are some continuities of relationship. And Kamosi wrote me this really nice letter when I told him that Patrice had said, the first thing I remember about the book is that it's alive, that you open up the book and it's like somebody is in there, a person is in there talking to you, but the first 60 pages are almost too painful to read. And then Mark Anthony Johnson, but the good part is it ends with the third Reconstruction. It doesn't put you through all that pain just to bring you back to the history of revolution and counter-revolution, revolution and counter-revolution. It brings you into a hopeful possibility of revolution in the real world today. Now this book, which I am very proud of, and Kamosi said to me, because Leanne worked so hard, my wife Leanne Hurst Mann, we worked for just months and months and months editing this book. He said, you know the importance of editing? You know the importance of changing and listening to every word is you may someday get a young person who hangs on every word. And if they hang on every word, make sure that's the word that you plan to say. Because some folks don't read it. And they go, yeah, it was really good, the thing about slavery or something. But some people really, really read it. And they're going to ask you questions about it. So I want to talk about making the book into a tactic in the movement. We need your help to buy a lot of books tonight. We'd like you to consider buying what we call a 10-pack. The book is $15. It's already been discounted to $10, and a lot of you know that there was no real admission here. We paid for everything, so you could get the first book with your admission. If you could buy 10 copies of the book, you could take 5 for yourself and give them to friends or sell them to friends. And say to your friends, if I give it to you, will you promise if you like it that you'll buy 5 books? This is sort of a reverse Amway, see? Instead of you making money, you try to get this work out. Secondly, you could say, I want to buy 10, 5 for myself and my friends, and 5 to go down to New Orleans in my name. Because on the 21st of August, Patrice Cullors, Mark Anthony Johnson, Francisca Porchas, Damon Azali, and myself are going down for 10 days to New Orleans to work with groups. I just was told by Zocha Bavera today, I said, did you get the books already? And she said, Eric, when the books first came, folks in New Orleans were arm wrestling over who would get the first copies. So there's a lot of groups that are really hungry to get those books, and you can help us get those books to New Orleans. The second thing is, would you, if you teach class, as a high school teacher, buy books and offer them to your students, not necessarily as a course adoption, but as just giving them the chance to read it and presenting it to them. Third, if you're a college professor, will you adopt this for your course? Fourth, if you're a college student, will you forcefully and persuasively encourage your college professor to adopt it for her or his course? But we'd like to move a lot of books tonight. A lot of you have come and bought one book. There's certainly almost 200 people here tonight. We hope that we could sell 500 books, which means that you would average three a book, you know, three books per person, and see yourself as a book organizer. And later on, Patrice Cullors is going to come up and lead the discussion, and here's how we're going to do it. For those people who have a moment to think, who would like to talk about ordering five books or more, we're going to go into the audience and have you testify. Then we're going to have a book signing where I'll be up here and be very, very happy to sign your books. And then finally, we're going to come back and have questions and answers. For some of you, it may be too late, but we're not in a hurry. And in New York, we did this, and to our surprise, more than half the people, even after all the book signing, they stayed and talked to us. So I'm going to end before I bring up Patrice, and thank you so much. What am I going to end with? I got more, Carol. I already finished my minute. Now I can just go into free play. Is that right? Okay. So, woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. I woke up this morning with my mind set on freedom. I woke up this morning with mine set on freedom. Hallelujah, hallelujah, hallelujah. Everybody gotta walk, you gotta talk, you gotta walk with your mind on freedom. Gotta walk, you gotta talk, you gotta walk with your mind on freedom. Ooh, yeah, hallelujah, 'cause we are soldiers in the army. We're gonna fight, although we have to die. We're gonna hold the bloodstained banner. We're gonna hold it up until we die. Well, Medgar Evers, he's in the army. He had to fight until he had to die. We're gonna hold up a bloodstained banner. We're gonna hold it up until we die. We shall overcome. I know that we shall overcome. I know that we shall overcome someday. Well, deep in my heart, I know that I do believe. Wah, we shall overcome someday. That's the SNCC version, everybody. So So I thought, you know, a lot of you know I'm a contradictory figure. So I thought I'd end by singing the national anthem. Because, you know, I mean, you may think that's contradictory because I called it the White Settler States of America. Because I think the United States is arming Israel to inflict war crimes on the people of Lebanon. Because as a Jew, I support the Palestinian people. So you may ask, why am I singing the national anthem? The answer is because I didn't tell you which national anthem I'm going to sing. It ain't going to be those folks. It's going to be what originally was called the Negro National Anthem, and we now call the Black National Anthem. And I hope you would, for those of us who know it, would join us. And, oh good, we have it on those green cards. How many folks here can sing from the back who know this song? All right, well, we're going to teach it to you and learn it together. Okay? We're going to try to get on key.
Stand up.
Please stand. Ready?
Lift every voice and sing till let that heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening sky. Let it resound loud as the rolling sea. Sing a song full of the faith that the dark past has taught us. Sing a song full of the hope that the present has brought us. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on till victory is won. Facing the rising sun of our new day begun, let us march on till victory.
Okay, hold up everybody, don't get up now. Please stay, we're not done.
Just one, two, test, one, two.
Thank you everybody for staying as long as you can, for watching this, for experiencing this. The next part we wanna do is get y'all to buy the book. This is definitely a day, a really powerful day. A really powerful book has been written, and we want to get this book out in the streets. We're going to be passing around the sheet. It says, how will you help build the third reconstruction? Okay, because we take things real serious here at the Strategy Center. One of the things we're asking folks, how many people here are college professors or college students that would help get this be a course adoption in their classroom? Raise your hand. Okay, well, tonight's the night to make that happen. So can I get my first person that will testify on what you will do to get this in your classroom? Don't be scared. It's not a time to be scared. Come on. And say your name, who you are.
My name is Yana Flores. I'm a student at UC Riverside. I'm chair of MECHA. I work with anti-prison work in UC Riverside, and we have this dope, a couple of dope-ass professors that do anti-prison work, and also, I guess, anti-racist work. So I think that a lot of times, like you guys were mentioning, that you have the history of the movement and then the suppression of the movement, but there isn't that third reconstruction aspect to it, and so there's many dope people who are open to this, and I will definitely collab on at least getting two professors to incorporate in that.
Great. I really want to focus tonight too on how many people can actually get the books in their hands tonight, buy 5 books, buy 10 books, buy 20 books tonight. So who can I get to say that they'll buy their first 5 books tonight? Got someone in the back? This brother in the back? Oh, this brother right here. Wait, we got someone in the back.
I want 10.
You want 10? Can you say your name?
What's your name, brother?
Yeah. I had arranged, I went over to the office last week and I had arranged from the Paul Robeson Community Center Forum to get 10 books, and I bought one while I was there. I read it through. I wanted to ask one question, if I may, and because I'm, well, I was in New Orleans for a little while when I grew up from 7 years old, so I went to the Army. But I'm from Plaquemine Parish, and I know none of the organizations that I've been attending has anything to say about what happened to Plaquemine Parish. I don't think it got completely washed away, but it certainly does figure in the land stealing that went on in Louisiana, because we lost all of ours, and we did receive it back. But since the Katrina thing happened, we haven't heard of it again. And I had some newspaper clippings and things that I wanted to leave here, so see if somebody can give me some help on it. I happen to have a little piece about that big in New Orleans, and I haven't been able to find out too much about it, but I do want to get the 10 books and signed to send them to my kinfolk down there so I can begin them a little bit of organizing and see if we can get them.
Oh. Thank you, brother.
So we're going to save the question for later, but we're going to go to Barbara Ladd Holland.
And there's someone in the back, too.
Yes. Hi, everyone. Thank you guys for coming out. My daughter was very moved tonight, and she is purchasing 15 books to give away at her baby shower this Saturday. So I've got a challenge for folks in this room. I got a good friend right over here, Skim, who does work in the juvie. Which juvie?
Los Padrinos and Central East Lake Juvenile Halls.
Okay, so she's talked to 100 kids in juvenile detention, in 2 juveniles, and she says she's willing to take books into juvie. So that's 100 books at $500, $5 a piece. I want to know who in this room is willing to help me get those 100 kids those books. And I'm willing to put in $50. So I'm willing to buy the first 5 of those 100 books. Who's down with me?
You got a hand right here?
On behalf of the man and Ward Wallace family, we want to buy 10 books for Juvie, as well as 10 books for to go to New Orleans in the name of Ava Lily Ward Wallace, the newest member of the Third Reconstruction. Woo! And 6 of the books to go to our black brothers in the Los Angeles Fire Department. Mm.
Again to Tali. Say your name, where you're from, and how many books you're going to buy.
Hi, I'm Tali. I'm from Los Angeles. I've already bought 2 books, one to send to a friend, one for myself. I'll donate $20 for the getting the books out to the kids in juvie.
Thank you, Tali.
Yeah.
Mi nombre es María Francisca Aguirre. Conozco cada uno de los miembros y los participantes del Centro de Estrategia y del Sindicato de Pasajeros. Ellos han sido mi escuela, ellos han sido, han crecido mi conciencia. Ahora estoy recibiendo clases bilingües en Pacific Oaks College Pasadena. Conozco 5 maestros que nos dan clases y dan clases a high school. Entonces quiero donar estos libros para ellos y quiero comprar 10 libros porque no quiero quedarme atrás. Gracias.
So my name is María Francisca Aguirre, and I know each and every one of the members and staff members of the Bus Riders Union. This has been my school, and I'm currently taking bilingual classes in Pasadena, and I want to be able to take 10 books because I don't want to fall behind, get left behind. I want to buy 10 books to be able to give to them.
Thank you so much.
I've already bought 5 books, but I'm going to buy 5 more for the juvie.
Thank you, Carol.
Did my mom teach me well?
Right here, Damon. Dan.
Dan, where's that?
I'd like to buy, I was going to just buy 5 books for myself and 5 to send down to New Orleans. I'll add an additional 10 books for the juvie.
My name is Steven. I'm a former member of the staff of this amazing organization. I want to give $100 to send 20 books to the kids in juvie.
No, I just want to say that I will get 10 books. I'll 5 for youth and 5 for the juvies.
Awesome.
Other folks? Don't be shy.
Carla.
I have a donation from Melinda Hurst. She gave $60 for books for New Orleans.
Great. That's amazing. Yeah, so thank you so much, everybody, for giving your donations, for buying this book, bringing them to the juvenile halls, bringing them to New Orleans. We want to start the book signing process. And Tammy?
You can help make pledges for bringing it into the colleges or whatever you would do. So those who wanted to participate, but we don't have time right now for you to actually publicly state your support, go ahead and fill these out and pass it along to the sides, and we'll make sure to contact you.
So come on up, make a line right here. We're going to start signing books. Please come up, get your book signed.
Where?